And now Reverend Elizabeth Price has the message for us.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So good to see you and be here again this week. It's 2 weeks in a row. Kind of like it. So we are living in some very troubling and interesting times. So I wanted to lift up some of the question. Annie and I were having a little email back and forth about this. I think you've kind of dealt with this before, but is there a tension or is there a tension between living in community and asserting individual freedoms? So that's a question. And I think one of the things I love about this congregation and other UU congregations is we just explore the questions. Do we come out with a big answer? Maybe sometimes there's this consensus, but a lot of times it's just holding open the space to explore the questions. So let's do that today. Is there a tension between living in community, also think family, and being valued and known and being able to assert individual freedoms? So I'm going to say yes and no. How about that? Okay, so starting out when we're young, we are born into families and our developing brains take a look at what our parents are doing. If they take us to places like churches, schools, we kind of look at what other people are doing and we start to put together how to be in these social structures. So children are sponges for this. They repeat exactly what parents say out in the world to others, and sometimes parents don't want that repeated out in the world. And so the kid has done something wrong, and that's a shock, and oh my goodness. So if we have wonderful, healthy parents and environments for these spongy brains that we're helping to shape, then they are able to reflect on what just happened and to develop more of a discernment of what to say when, what to do where, things like that. So in healthy environments, too, rather than being forced to comply with a bunch of rules, we give children choices. Even at Riley Hospital for Children, they're coming for these procedures, surgeries, sometimes lives are on the line, and there are these wonderful people, child life specialists, who come in, and even the smallest of children, to develop self-agency in an overwhelming environment where really there's not a lot of choice for this child. We're going to give the child the life-saving treatment. But the questions are, you have to have an IV. Which arm would you like to have that one in? And if they don't want it at all, then teddy bear or the cute little doll comes out, and then the child gets to talk with the bear, practice what's going to happen to them in the surgery. They'll get to see an IV pole. They'll get to see what happens and learn about the experience through play. Children's imaginations are wonderful, and these sponges pick up what's happening and start to say, okay, well, my right arm would be good for that. And so developing as much choice as possible. So there's freedom, even in the constrictions of what is going to happen. Freedom for the child. So we also, my parents weren't good at this. If I didn't comply with the rules, I usually got punished at home. So if I did something, which I only did once, because I wanted to be good and I wanted my teachers to love me and all of that. But one time I did not follow the rules, and not only did my teacher get mad at me, but also my parents did too. So, that was a lot. What I learned was to obey. But how would it have been if they had given me some choice? You know, you can either pay attention to the teacher who's talking or talk with your friend. If you pay attention to the teacher, you get to learn. But if you talk with your friend, you have to stop. You have to go out in the hallway and think about what you were doing. But it's up to you. What would you like to choose? And then the consequences of that would be on me as the child. When I was six, I didn't know anything. So anyway, but to give children choices to, and also to, in within the safety of adult supervision, experience the consequences and then learn from the choice. That's ideal. Now, if the child is running toward the street with cars and stuff, you don't give them that choice. But if it's safe, let them discern, let them choose, let them kind of understand that there are consequences to choices. Once I didn't want a vaccine and I put up such a big fight, they didn't give it to me, and then I got the illness. So I learned, get your vaccines. So life lessons. But when children are given space to make choices that have consequences, they have a better sense of, I don't have to rebel against the powerful authority that's going to punish me. I can think through this. I can have support from those authorities. Sadly, though, I see far more people who are parented by demands, by rules, by you do what I say, not as I do, and then the consequences are usually not so profitable for the child. So these children, what happens to them when they grow up? Well, sometimes, like I was, very shy, very withdrawn, just wanting to blend in and not get too much attention toward me. So I've changed. I grew. So I'm not like that anymore so much. I do have a little bit of that in me. I do like, you know, to go by the rules. But I have some sense of frontal lobe development that if I do this, then this will happen. But also, some of these children, without interventions, become bullies. They become the one that is the authority to punish, the authority to say what's what. The strong, they get to set the rules. The weak have to comply with them. Of course, we're seeing a lot of that in our country today. And all across the United States, there was protest after protest against such an authoritarian ruler, no kings. And very much encouraged that about 50% or more of people in this country do not want this sort of government. And so I think we're seeing the outpouring of this, and any movement like this, it has to come from the people. We're not seeing it from our leaders in government, but the people are speaking and people are listening. So bullies grow up, they want to be rugged individuals. They want to be at the top of the food chain because anything less makes them weak, and it triggers their traumas from being bullied at home. Bullies, as well as the withdrawing types, don't have freedom of choice. Both of these things are reactions. To move against other people with aggression is a reaction. To withdraw from aggressive people is a reaction. This is not freedom of choice. So the hope of a strong man leader who will hand out the ability to preserve many people's rugged individualism has been a theme in our country since really right after the Civil War. And it's waxed and waned over the years. But this is the subject of, at least when I was a kid, some of my favorite TV shows and movies about the Wild Wild West. And these cowboys, it's a myth. Honestly, they didn't exist. It came from Hollywood. It came from this the collective unconscious that wants this freedom to do whatever they feel is right. And so it's a myth. Actual cowboys were Spanish. They were African Americans. They were a real diverse group of people who were caring for cattle, moving from range to range. And they were hard workers, and they had families, and they sat in circles and sang songs. So they did some of those things. But it was a community, a true community of people, not groups of rugged individualists just doing whatever the heck they wanted to do. So Heather Cox Richardson, history professor at Boston College, writes about this, the myth of the white male cowboy, rugged individualists, and argues that the crisis in our country today is the result of a 40-year-old Republican ideology she terms as cowboy individualism. So in her recent book, Democracy Rising, I read that on vacation. It was intense. She asserts that this version of an American is based on the myth that came from the Civil War. It reemerged in the 50s and 60s as kind of this ideal way of existing and is prevalent again now. And as evidenced by the violent attempt to overthrow or overturn the 2020 election, and it's continuing today in our movement that threatens our freedom of speech, that threatens anything about having diversity, equity, and inclusive communities, and the threat of violence always comes with it. This is the group of bullies. So it's not just white males, it's everyone that participates in this that really wants a leader to follow. So the withdrawing types and the aggressive types. So she reiterated this in a lecture not long ago at the University of British Columbia. So I'm going to read a little excerpt of it. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. So, is that what we're seeing here? The wish to operate outside the government. I have no use for a government that makes me pay taxes, that makes me do things that I do not want to do. So, they champion the idea of this individualism and embraces the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white males in general, or white people, to black Americans, people of color, and women who demand equal rights. In other words, DE&I. So we're seeing an effort to do away with that in our institutions. So when cowboys push back against society governed by community principles with amendments that provide for individual rights but don't necessarily include them, they are reacting out of a fear of losing that mythical place that really doesn't exist. And they're fighting for it. They're reacting for it. We're also seeing pushback from more than half of Americans who are not happy with the current stripping of the government. And so we're seeing protests. all over the United States. We're hearing our allies and friends in many other countries standing with us in solidarity. One of the pictures I saw on Facebook was an American in Germany, and her sign said, had an American flag and said, "We are not okay." And that was heartbreaking. So what does all of this mean for us today with our question? Can we be individuals and free within a community? So I just want to say community building is hard work. It requires us to be with each other through chaos, through not knowing what to expect from each other, until we can really sit with each other through the ups and downs of true community. So sometimes there is tension between the rights or needs of individuals and the need of the community. So I teach this at university, at IU Health, as an educator, small group education, and the goal of that is to build community in that small group, believing that our students will go and help families that they care for build community, the staff that works together build community, and then go out to their congregations and help congregations build true community. So that is really monumental work, and people grasp it when they are with us. And it requires me as the educator to be that calm, assertive self that helps them look at their process. So Scott Peck, you know, I like him for a lot of things. He wasn't perfect, as none of us are, but M. Scott Peck in his book, A Different Drum, outlined these four stages of community building. First is pseudo-community, where we're full of projections and assumptions about each other. If we're gathered here today, we're all like-minded. We're all for doing the things that we all do, and there's really not that much diversity among us. So the way you think is the way I think, and the way I think is the way you think. You probably agree with me on everything, and we find what we have in common and celebrate it. Yay, we're doing this together. But I see a lot of smiles because I think we all know somewhere deep down inside we are not all alike. We don't all believe the same things or think the same things or even want the same things for this congregation. The depth of relationship remains on the surface in pseudo-community, where we don't have to get into anything too messy. Because, hey, that would be hard work. And who wants to do that, especially on a Sunday? But if we are willing to, and I bet people do this in classes and in, you know, learning about each other more in the circle, when we actually start to strip away this surface level stuff, we do enter into conflict. It's inevitable. If we're going to be real, we're going to find out that we disagree on some things. We're going to feel disappointed with each other. We're going to have these disagreements without clear ways of managing them. And then how will we ever get through this? And sometimes people look to a strong person to tell us, here's what you need to do. Don't see lots of smiles on that one. Because I think this group is committed to managing and working in the chaos, especially when the chaos is beyond the walls. But if we're going to build true community, then learning how to disagree, learning to hold the space open for different opinions. And I have sat around the table at the coffee hour, and I've heard many different opinions expressed there with curiosity, with openness, with more questions from people sitting around the table. And I think they're like, this is a great place to be, to learn, to grow, to explore, that my worldview is my tiny worldview. You've had so many different experiences than I have. I get to learn here and grow here and share myself here. So what a beautiful thing. I haven't seen, and this is what my students come with, is, you know, at my house, if I disagreed, I was sent to my room, or worse. So I dare not. And if you're the leader who's going to give me a grade, I definitely will not disagree with you. Let's just stay happy. And I'm like, well, I'll give you a bad grade if you don't challenge me or other people. It's expected. We have to do the work in order to have true community and learn. So when people learn that they can survive the chaos, then they begin to empty themselves of expectations of each other. Like, I'm going to throw this out. You may agree or disagree. And I would love to hear your opinions about it and your thoughts or reactions. But I can really let go of expecting you to be my best friend and be my yes person. So that's what Pat calls the emptying stage. And sometimes it's hard to get past that or past the chaos to get into that, because some people come to the group, whatever it is, with this need for like-minded people. It doesn't mean we're not like-minded people, but we're different and we have different experiences. So when that can come to the surface, the difference within the shared experience, there's a common purpose that develops and a sense of belonging. I belong here because I'm different from you and everybody else in the world. I belong here because you value what I'm bringing. I belong here because I can say what I think and feel, and people are open to hearing it. That is very affirming. And now I don't need you to agree with me on everything. I need you to listen. I need you to have empathy. And I need for you to offer your thoughts and feelings and experiences so I can listen and have empathy. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's what Pat calls true community. So the question of individual freedom versus community is a false dichotomy. In fact, individual freedom creates community. If you cannot offer your free sense of self here, you can't help create community. It's risky. It's scary. You risk being yourself. You risk not belonging. You risk really some of the things that you hope to get from this place. But you're claiming, I'm claiming choice. And I'm claiming self-agency. Just like the Riley patient gets to choose what arm. As that child develops, they start to discern what is good for them, what is not good for them. They start to discern who their allies are to get help in asserting themselves, and they learn to support and encourage other people. What is the common purpose here? To grow in knowledge and spiritual development, to grow in our ability to assert ourselves, to stand up for what is true and right as we discern that, and to help keep the rails on a civil society. There's accountability here. Individuals choose. So we're not cowboys and cowgirls out on the range in the wild, wild west, even though that sounds fun sometimes. We join communities and build community. We're peacemakers and seekers. So we're inclusive thinkers, and we're willing to take a stand on what we think, feel, and believe. Amen.
Does anyone have any questions for Reverend Price or any salient thoughts on the message?
Did I address it, Annie?
I think one of the things that helps in the UU Church is the principles.
Yeah.
Or the values, which we just got last year, which I see them as different ways of looking at the same thing. And in fact, the UUA has said, because we have the values doesn't mean we can't use the principles. But at any rate, I think most of the time if there's a conflict and we turn to the principles, it will help us figure out how to solve those. And I don't think you were here a couple of weeks ago when I mentioned ouch oops. This is something that comes from youth cons. And if somebody says something that bothers you at a youth con, you say ouch. You say ouch, and the person says oops. And then they have an opportunity, if they don't understand why that hurt the other person, to ask about it and find out what they missed.
I like that.
So.
That's great.
Anybody else?
Something that you said earlier in the message that really spoke to me was about children who were raised in authoritarian households becoming bullies, because that was me my dad, I talk a lot about my parents, like I call them the good kind of Christians a lot of times. They're still very conservative, but they raised me and my siblings with good values, and I always say that I left the Christian church because of the Christian values that they raised me with. They still had a lot of the hang-ups and downsides of conservative Christianity, and my dad at one point described himself as a tyrant in our household in a benevolent, strongman type leader, like, you do what I say because what I say is good, is best for you, mm-hmm. Even if you don't like it. And I wasn't, like, physically or mentally strong enough to overpower my siblings, but I was the oldest, and so I felt like I should have the authority to do so. And to tell my siblings what to do, which is why my parents generally left my sister in charge most of the time, which I was very upset about, but she was just better at it than I was. I see that same instinct in, like you said, a lot of the people who are getting behind this strongman type leader, because that was, I was very much on that path and that trajectory, and it took a lot of good and caring people who were different from me to teach me to be different and accept people who are different. And so that's just a very important thing to recognize, that these people are often victims of that kind of upbringing and treatment and societal treatment, and they need patience and care and to come around to our side.
Yeah, they need patience and care, but also they are responsible to reparent themselves like you have been able to do, to reflect on your life and to say, I don't need to be caught in this this prison of reacting. And I know that's very hard for people to face, the feeling of shame that they're doing things to hurt themselves or others. But I think part of what individually needs to happen. And this is also hard for my students, and it's been hard for me, is to face who I truly am because of that background, and then be able to make different choices. So with awareness comes choices. And then we are adults here, responsible for the choices we make. So thank you for sharing that. Yep.
One example of how pervasive that is in our lives is that I was taught at a very early age not to ask questions. And I still struggle with that today at my age.
Yeah. Yes, those early messages are very hard to, like it becomes chatter in the brain because you obviously have asked questions and things. So, but it's kind of always with us. Was for me, the sponge took it in and stored it away somewhere. Yep.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you for that. Thank you for every message you bring in here. I learned something, and it's good for me. And I think somebody agrees. But on this subject, the current situation, we're into two groups. Speaking for myself, totally, I don't want to have to deal with that other group. We have our own friends, we have our own church.
Mm-hmm.
And at our age, it's not worth the hassle. And my neighbor next door, he went out at a Trump rally last year during the election season. He had a big flag dragging behind his car and everything. But we just don't talk about those things. And he's a good mechanic, so I meet him around. So.
Yeah, yes, your relationship has been reduced to what you do for each other or what he does for you. And that he's not part of your community, even though he's your neighbor. So, yeah, the discerning brain, the discerning mind, says how much involvement can I really do? But what you can do, what you are doing, is you're participating in this community. You're speaking up. You're sharing your truth. And you are open to learn and grow. And that is a well-lived life that you can reflect and say what you see. And you do that here. There are people here who go to the protest, who stand up and do some of those things, who would go to your neighbor and say, that sign is offensive to me, or the neighborhood association in our case, and say, no political flags, please, and sort of address those things. But everybody has a role. It's different, depending on where you are in life.
Hi.
Hi.
There was a really good quote that I saw the other day. I'm not sure if it was a tweet or if it was from someone actually credible, but
yep.
It said, the price you pay for community is discomfort. And I think that's become very true as of late. Like you were saying, even in groups of like-minded people, we won't all get along or have the same opinions or even approaches to how we think things should be solved.
Yeah.
But part of existing in community with other people is learning what you can and can't put up with, I guess. And I'm trying to become more conscious about expanding my worldview and expanding my threshold for discomfort
mm-hmm.
by saying, like, okay, everyone clearly has what they think are their best intentions. I should at least hear them out a little bit. But it's hard.
Yes.
I'm not going to admit it's not hard. And I think consciously building community is something that is going to become more important to me as I get older. And mm-hmm. it's definitely something that I never grew up, I didn't grow up in church. I didn't grow up with a very robust community system around me. So it's weird learning about it when you're an adult.
Yes.
But I really appreciate the message.
Oh, you're welcome. It's so true that the price of community is discomfort. And but when we are in groups where we could risk discomfort and people receive it, then that really goes a long way at being able to go from here, let's say, to another community where I don't have to be comfortable. You know, I've got a place where I can assert myself and people listen. This is where I can assert myself and hold people accountable to listen. So safety in groups is overrated in some sense. So, but starting in places where it is safe to assert oneself is so important. Thank you.
And I just want to add a little addendum to that. Just that it's not just discomfort of having your beliefs or ideas challenged or like being in community with people who are different from you, but also just doing things for the benefit of other people when you don't particularly want to. And maybe emotionally or mentally you want to help, but physically you don't feel like you have the energy or the time, but like sacrificing that to be a part of your community because you know that somebody in the past or in the future has done or will do the same for you. And that's another part of the discomfort that we have to subject ourselves to be a part of community. And I also wanted to respond to your response to what I said in that, of course, too much tolerance breeds intolerance, and if we tolerate bigoted ideas or regressive ideas, then that gets us to where we are now. But what I mean when I say the patience and care with people is engaging with, well, I work in construction and I work with a lot of very conservative people, and I talk to people about politics and I tell them, like, we can agree to disagree on things, and my goal is to get them to realize that we agree on a lot more than they realize. And a lot of the things that they think are actually more aligned with how most of us think politically than they realize. And socialism is not a bad word. And I also tell them that I think that this idea that we can't talk about politics or religion or sex or gender or identity or any of these things has gotten us to the point where if we talk about any of those things and we have any kind of disagreements, then the other person is evil or stupid or whatever. But just Friday, I was talking to a younger guy, like 19 or 20, that I work with, who I've talked to before, and we've had good conversations, and it's been like several months since I've talked to him, and we started talking again at work, and he was like, yeah, I fall on the right side of the aisle, but like, some of the things that they've been doing lately, it makes me think that you guys kind of have a point. And exactly. And we had a whole, like, several hours long conversation about, like, socialism and racism and patriarchy and all of these, like, things that are in place. And, like, we didn't agree on everything, but we, like, had a, like, we had a good nuanced conversation about, like, and that's what I mean, is that, like, if you, like, invite these people into your community, into your space, especially if you work with them every day and you can't really avoid that, then eventually you'll get people who will start to realize some things and start to come around. And maybe you won't agree on everything, but you can at least agree on the things that are important.
Well, and I don't know about you, but when I talk with my friends who, you know, fall on the other side of the aisle, and I do, I learn so much about how that person developed their views. And these numbers that we're seeing, 54%, 56% don't agree or want something different, all also believe different things. But I think we have more in common in that we needed reform. Everyone needs change and growing. That's who we are as creatures. And but we don't always agree on what we need. So I think that you're making wonderful points there.
Does anyone have a last comment to make before we move on?